Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Americans have become very cynical about their government. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Even before this unusually fractious election year, many of us had the sense that presidential candidates can't or won't do what they set out to do. And there have been real failures in modern history, from the long delay in freeing American hostages in Iran, to the misinformation about Iraq's possession of weapons of mass destruction, to the crashing of the website created to allow us to sign up for insurance under the Affordable Care Act. Adults who live in the real world understand that no leader can fulfill every promise to the satisfaction of every constituent. But as my guest will explain, there is a pattern to the ways that modern presidents have underperformed, which suggests there may be also a workable strategy for preventing certain kinds of blunders. Elaine C.K. Mark is Senior Fellow in the Governance Studies Program at Brookings and Founding Director of the Center for Effective Public Management, and she's on faculty at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Her new book is called Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again. Elaine, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you for having me, Chris.
You note in the book one of President Bill Clinton's favorite expressions is that most people think the government can't organize a two-car funeral. At the DNC last week, he said two-car parade, so I guess he's amended that a little bit. But regardless, you say government insiders now feel that we can't get as far as that two-car procession.
Yes, that's right. One of the things that this book is about is the relationship between the president and the very big government that he or she takes over when they are inaugurated. And it's my observation that one of the failures of our recent presidents has been that their distance from the federal government means that they make two kinds of mistakes. Either they don't understand what the government knows and how that knowledge can help them, or they misunderstand the capacity of the government to do what they think the government ought to be doing, to implement their policies. So this is really a book about that urges presidents to spend more time governing and less time talking.
Just for purposes of this discussion, define for us what you mean by failure.
Failure are what I mean are the big crash and burn failures. Okay, the ones that there's no argument about. The ones I deal with in the book are the failures of the Iranian hostage rescue mission in 1980, the failure to foresee the quagmire of Iraq during the Bush administration, the failure of Hurricane Katrina, the response to Hurricane Katrina, the failure of the websites in the Obama administration, and the failure to foresee the crisis in the Veterans Administration in the Obama administration. So it's a very bipartisan look. I look at Democratic presidents and Republican presidents, and it's not a partisan question. It's a question of when a president decides that he or she wants to do something, how do they do it? How can they make sure that it's implemented properly? When it's not implemented properly, it just blows up in their faces.
Earlier this week, Republican Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin published a blistering op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that noted when government fails, often the proposed solution is more government. It's a classic conservative argument, but you can't help but recognize the irony of that regardless of your politics.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, but, you know, here's the problem. If we want government to get out of lines of business, we should just get them out of it. In other words, just stop doing things. But what we've been doing as a nation for several decades now is we haven't stopped doing anything, right? We haven't stopped doing loans from the Export-Import Bank. We haven't stopped environmental regulations. All we do is we cut the budgets and cut the number of people responsible for doing them, which means that we continue to do everything badly. If you're a conservative, what you have to do is step back and say, look, there's some things we want the government to do we should fund it so they do them well. And then the other things, we should have the courage to just say no, just get rid of them. And I think Democrats have to have the same approach, even though they're not as anxious to cut as many things. You know, they have to be willing to say, look, get rid of what you don't want the government to do, but stop us being in this weird never-never land where we have laws on the books that say things ought to be done, and then we cut across the board so that everybody does everything badly, including the things that we want done well.
So one way to boil down the responsibilities of the president, and you alluded to this earlier, is into these three broad categories. You have policy, you have communication, and you have implementation. It's funny that communication is even in there. I mean, we know that we want to hear from the president, but it's become this kind of bloated thing when you put it on the scale with implementation and policy.
Yeah, and that is an observation that's not unique to me. It starts with a book called Going Public by Sam Kernell, who about a decade ago started measuring the amount of time that our modern presidents are talking and traveling, speech making and traveling. And lo and behold, over the course of this century, it goes up and up and up. And I've worked in the White House, and anybody else who's worked in the White House knows that when you have those senior staff meetings in the morning, all the attention is on the message of the day and what the president is going to say, as opposed to what the government is actually doing. So it's my contention that the modern presidency has gotten this out of whack, that they spend too much time and effort on communication, not enough time and effort on implementing policy and what the government is actually doing. And then when they suffer these big failures, these big crash and burn failures, what do they discover? They discover that you can't talk your way out of failure, that all your speech making and ad making and talent at visuals is useless when there are millions of people trying to get onto a website that keeps crashing.
None of this is helped by the perpetual campaign cycle of modern political life. Do presidents tend to get more done, Elaine, when they have second terms and toward the end of that second term, attention shifts to whoever is running to succeed them?
Well, there's a funny problem there, because the second term problem, first of all, presidents in their second terms generally have a lot of problems getting things done, but not because by that time they actually know what the government is and they know what it can do, et cetera. But by that time, a lot of the government and the lawmaking processes go into slow motion, just waiting out the president and waiting for the new president. So it doesn't necessarily improve in the second term, but not for the same reasons.
Okay, so why are modern presidents more distant from the governments they run than their predecessors were? We know, for instance, that government is bigger today than it was a century ago, but is there more than that to this distance?
It stems from that fact, okay? The government is gargantuan, okay? It employs millions of people. It spends much more money than the top Fortune 500. It employs more people than the top six employers in the United States. And it's complicated to figure out what it does. And so what happens is a president comes in, and the people who he or she immediately surrounds themselves with are people who they campaigned with, people who are experts in talking, messaging, talking, doing television ads, etc. And so that's what they keep doing for a while. You know, it takes them a while to realize that the government they are running can either help them avoid big mistakes, or it can get them into big trouble, and that the sort of political skills that they honed during the campaign and which won them the campaign are actually not very useful when they have a great big screw up, and that they have to pay more attention to the government that they're running.
Help us understand the difference just in style between political appointees and, say, career bureaucrats that might be working right beneath them in particular government agencies.
There's a huge difference. It's a stylistic difference and it's a cultural difference as well. The career bureaucrats are generally professional people. Today's modern government is the most well-educated workforce in the world. Not just in the United States, but it's in the world. Because we have computers doing clerical chores, it is now a government of doctors, lawyers, nuclear physicists, molecular biologists, etc. And that workforce knows a great deal about their particular slice of the pie. The political appointees often come in with great policy background in a certain area, but they often have no managerial talents, and they are put in charge of entities that have 100,000 employees. And often they cannot figure out how this operation works, and more importantly, how to implement the changes that their president wants or that they want. So there's a big divide, and in that divide, you have some hostility sometimes in some administrations. You have some distrust. And we need to close that gap. The political appointees need to understand what the career people know. And the career people need to help the political appointees implement the policies of the president who just got elected.
Meanwhile, you note that some presidents really feel like victims of the federal government rather than the leaders of it. They feel like if only these people would cooperate with me, I could be the star.
Yeah, I mean, it's that is one indication of the state we've come to. And there's a certain amount of stereotyping. Republican presidents tend to come in thinking that the whole darn thing is just a great big mess and that they're all against him. Democratic presidents come in thinking that, oh, these are my people and they're going to do everything I want to do exactly right all the time. And of course, in an entity this big, the important thing to remember for a president is something is always going wrong and something is always going right at exactly the same time. So one of the examples I use in the book is, as you mentioned earlier, the crashing of the healthcare websites when they were rolled out in October of 2013. What is not usually remembered is just 2 months after that, in December of 2013, two American astronauts did a 5.5-hour spacewalk where they repaired a cooling system on the space station while tethered to the station and being floating out there in space. Now, after the website crash, everybody, including President Obama, said, oh, the government has a terrible problem with information technology and technology. But over at NASA, some bureaucrat had contracted with the people who make spacesuits for astronauts, and people had contracted with Boeing, which runs the space station. And in other words, exactly the same system produced failed healthcare websites and the miracle of two men walking in space, which goes to show that at any given point in time, you've got a lot of good and a lot of screw-ups going on. And a president needs to understand how to anticipate those.
We're speaking this hour with Elaine C. Kmark. She's senior fellow in the Governance Studies program at Brookings and founding director of the Center for Effective Public Management. She's also on the faculty at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Her new book is called Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Elaine C. Kmark of Brookings, who is founding director of the Center for Effective Public Management and author of the new book, Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can email think@kera.org. You note that some presidential failures are about things that happen well below the level of the president, right? Which is to say that we understand mm-hmm. that Barack Obama was not going to be checking lines of code for healthcare.gov.
Right.
George W. Bush was not going to pack up Air Force One and fly down and hand out supplies to Hurricane Katrina victims. Why, though, is it important to hold them accountable anyway?
Well, first of all, the American public holds them accountable. When a president has one of these great big crash and burn failures, their popularity plunges dramatically. Their political capital goes down. It hurts their ability to do other things on their agenda. For Jimmy Carter, the failure of the hostage crisis was a powerful factor in the fact that he lost in a landslide in November to Ronald Reagan. So it hurts them. But more importantly, what a president needs to be aware of is what I call in the book organizational capacity. In other words, was FEMA capable of responding to the kind of disaster that happened to New Orleans? Ironically, just months before the hurricane hit, FEMA had played a war game with a Category 5 hurricane hit and found that, gee, things wouldn't go so well. They were really not very prepared. It's that sort of thing that you see repeatedly in these presidential failures. There are people who know where the capacity is and where the capacity is not in the federal government. And the last people who seem to know it are the president and his people.
What could presidents do in order to understand that information? Maybe to, this is simplistic, but, you know, have the folks at NASA consulting for the folks at healthcare.gov on how you really do a whiz-bang job with software.
Yeah. What presidents need to do is spend a time in their first year, not campaigning, not running around the country. They have to spend time understanding the government that they've got. All this information is there. It's in GAO reports. It's in Congressional Research Service studies. It's in academic work. In other words, and it's on the street, frankly, okay, in Washington. People tend to know which agencies get it right, which agencies are in crisis or near crisis. And a president can create a White House staff to help him get a good sense of the government he's inherited, the pluses and the minuses, so that he or she can then use that government in the best way possible. And look, you're not going to avoid all failures, right? But you do want to reduce the probability of failure. And a simple example is President Obama gave his health care plan, you know, his baby, to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, something we call in Washington CMS. Well, that organization was having trouble doing what it's already supposed to do, which is manage the massive Medicare and Medicaid programs. And it had been on the high-risk list, which is the list of agencies in trouble, for 15 years. Every year, this organization made the high-risk list. Now, why would you give your brand-new baby, your brand-new healthcare initiative, to an organization that was already struggling doing what it was supposed to do? That's the sort of thing presidents have to stop and think about, and they have to organize their White House so they can find out this kind of information.
Modern presidential candidates do a lot of promising about the things that will happen in their first 100 days, right? And I believe this started with FDR. Mm-hmm. And everybody looks to those 100 days, and this is when they try to come in and make, you know, sweeping changes to things that their voters really expressed an interest in. Do we need to set that aside in order to sort of build in this year of action, certainly, but also of really study and learning about what it means to be president and what the capacity of the government is?
Oh, we definitely do. This 100 days business, you know, it's gotten ridiculous. I mean, the reason Roosevelt had 100 days was because he came into office in the middle of the Great Depression. He had to do stuff because the economy was in a free fall. But other presidents should be careful about these 100-day promises because they tend to make promises in the campaign, and then they get into the White House and somebody says, well, you know, you really can't do that. Maybe the biggest example is President Obama's promise to close Guantanamo.
Right. We're still waiting for that.
Yeah. Here we are 7.5 years later and, you know, we haven't closed it. Or if Donald Trump should get elected, you know, his big promise is he's going to build a wall and make Mexico pay for it. Well, I suspect if he were president for 7.5 years, we'd still be waiting for the wall and we'd still be waiting for the check. You know, they're just things that sound good. You know, they sound good in front of a crowd and everybody yells and screams about and they sometimes get people elected. But then presidents can't deliver. And of course, when they can't deliver, it just adds to this cycle of cynicism that you mentioned at the beginning of the show. Cynicism about our government and about our system of government.
It's really hard to get a crowd fired up talking about your excellent managerial skills. How can we convince American voters and political parties to look at more than just the sort of presentation skills of candidates who want to be president?
This is a very difficult question. And the reason is that in the old-fashioned nomination process, where party primaries were few and far between, and even when they were held, they didn't mean much, presidents were nominated by all superdelegates, okay? They were nominated by their peers. Now, there were many problems with that system as well, don't get me wrong. But one advantage of that system is that other people in the business of government and politics evaluated potential presidents on their ability to do things like negotiate, do things like come out with a good, with a sensible policy, etc. This was a kind of semi-private process that went on in those days. And it's hard to imagine, for instance, a process like that giving us a candidate like Donald Trump, who clearly doesn't know very much about, you know, the government that he seeks to be the head of. So it's an interesting problem. Now, there's two sorts of ways to approach it. One is to kind of go back to the smoke-filled rooms, which I don't think is going to happen. But the other is to urge the press to get into their questioning, their intermediation of the candidates, some kind of question about, well, really, how are you going to do that? What does that mean? What department would implement that? Does that department have the ability to implement it? In other words, the third part of leadership, right? The first part being policy, the second part being communication, and third part being implementation, that needs to come to the fore because that's where presidents have really been falling down.
It sounds a little bit like you're describing what would amount to a much more exhaustive version of the civil service exam. You just want to make sure that folks have the skills to do the job America's hiring them for.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we forget. We are hiring somebody to do a job. We are hiring somebody to manage a very, very large government that does many important things. Whether you agree that they should be done or not is another question, but they do a lot of things. And the absence of any knowledge of this entity is going to make implementing policy really, really difficult for whoever gets elected. And we've seen this in the past.
All right, let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Asim on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Asim.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Very well, thanks.
I'm actually a former student at the Kennedy School, and I took Professor Kmark's class, so I just want to say I really appreciate that. And then,
hello, Asim. How are you?
I'm doing well. I love the class. It was you and Professor Gergen together, and I learned an incredible amount that I still tell other people today. So thank you for those insights. But the question I had was about one of the comments that you just made about political capital. And we talked about a lot of this in your class as well. But it seems to me that the definition or the utility of what we used to think of as political capital may be changing or may fall apart in a world where obstructionism is much more rewarded or prided in especially the one particular party. But I wonder what your thoughts are, if that's actually changing or you see that being redefined in the future.
Well, gee, it's great to hear from you, Asim. I can remember you, particularly because you have an unusual first name, so it sticks in my head. So it's wonderful to hear from you. And a great question. Part of the problem with today's governance is exactly as you said, obstructionism. But to the extent that a president has a lot of political capital, that allows him or her to go to Congress and to use some of that capital to break down the obstructionism. You know, we just had the defeat of Congressman Husel Camp in Kansas, who was one of the biggest naysayers in the Congress. Tim Huell's camp. He was one of the biggest naysayers in Congress. He was the leader of the Freedom Caucus. And he just lost by a very large margin to a Republican. This was a Republican primary who was much less obstructionist in his attitude. Equally conservative, but very, very much of the mind of let me see what I can get done for my agenda. And I think that the tide may beginning to turn on that, particularly if a president comes in with a great deal of political capital and therefore can use that political capital to help or hurt individual members of Congress.
This book is full of examples of mistakes, failures from the Obama administration, the George W. Bush administration, the Carter administration. I'm guessing it's not that you think that President George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton got everything right, but can you explain the differences between their failures and the ones of the three presidents that you more prominently feature here?
Yes. I don't have any failures from Reagan, Carter, or Reagan, Clinton, or George H.W. Bush. They all had their failures, of course, of different sorts. Reagan had the Iran-Contra affair. Clinton had the, affair with the intern. You know, they all kind of got themselves into various messes. But I was focusing on a particular kind of failure, the failure that results when a president doesn't understand or appreciate what the government knows or what trouble the government is in. So, for instance, there's a little piece of the State Department called INR that got the situation in Iraq exactly right before we went in there. And years before, the same agency had gotten the situation in Vietnam exactly right. And guess what? They were ignored by presidents both times, to the great, distress of our country and all the people who suffered from our involvement in those wars. So there are pieces of the government that actually know things that presidents should know. But if the presidents are ignoring them or don't even know that they're there, they're going to get in trouble. This is a particular kind of trouble. Reagan got himself in trouble. Clinton got himself in trouble. People can get themselves in trouble in other ways. The book focuses on a particular type of trouble.
All right. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Mario calling from Plano. Hi, Mario.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Great subject. I work in the professional field, and it just seems to me like our obviously elected leaders, don't have or don't exercise those basic skills that you would expect from a leader. The obvious one being leadership skills, also negotiating skills as well. They just don't seem to negotiate well with others. They kind of isolate themselves, if you will, and basically refuse to work together. I don't know if it's because of the environment, and I don't know if it, maybe there's some, you know, check and balance in our system to have them work together, but that's something that that I have noticed. And just a real quick question, do you feel that it would be better if the president or even Congress would be limited to terms? For example, the president just having one term of 5 or 6 years, do you feel that would be more productive versus spending their first term trying to get reelected to a second term?
Oh, thank you. That's a good question. You know, I guess I'm of two minds on the length of terms. Mexican presidents have only 1 6-year term. And while it does, in theory, it should allow you to focus a little bit more on the business of government, there are downsides to that, too, sort of downsides in democratic accountability. And as for your negotiation point, that's a terrific one. The whole American government is founded on the notion that we're going to compromise. We're going to compromise within Congress. We're going to compromise between the president and the Congress, where there's going to be compromises between the federal government and the states. And that has gone wildly out of fashion in the last 10 years. And I think it's got to come back into fashion if the government's going to start succeeding again.
We have an email here from Edward. I'm going to read a bit of it here, and maybe you can respond after we take our break. He says, would you please comment on the seeming determination of people in opposition to see to it that any particular president is not going to be able to accomplish anything? The current attitude of Republicans toward President Obama, summed up by Senator McConnell when Obama first took office, comes to mind, but it's by no means the first instance. So we will get your ideas on that in a moment. My guest is Elaine C. Kmark. She is Senior Fellow in the Governance Studies Program at Brookings, founding director of the Center for Effective Public Management, and on the faculty at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Her new book is called Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again. If you'd like to join our conversation, call 1-800-933-5372, email think at kera.org, or find us on Twitter at KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Elaine C. Kmark of the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Her new book is called Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Just before the break, we received this email from Edward. And Elaine, we've been talking mostly about the president's ability to act as sort of CEO of these different government agencies. But Edward wanted to know about the problem of obstructionism from the legislature.
Well, that is a very real and very big problem. And certainly when Majority Leader McConnell came in and said, we're going to do everything we can to defeat Obama, that didn't set a healthy tone. And obviously that tone has got to change. And frankly, one of the things that will change it is when one party or the other wins the next big landslide election. So that's a question. But, you know, I'll tell you, the other thing that happens is that a lot of activity goes on in the federal government without Congress. Rulemaking is a executive branch function almost exclusively. And that activity comes back to bite the president if it goes badly. And so just just straightforward things like getting veterans health care. When that, you know, there was no congressional involvement in the operations of those hospitals that were that had long waiting lists and were faking the data about the health care, right? They were simply not being managed well. And when that scandal broke, the president himself lost a lot of ground, lost a lot of popularity, had to take the blame because Americans do regard him as the CEO. And it really didn't have much to do with Congress at all. So a lot of the failures that presidents encounter are quite separate from Congress. And while you can lay the blame on Congress for not getting new things done, new legislation done, a lot of executive branch failures are purely that, executive branch failures.
Are there details that presidents are overlooking that they ought to be paying attention to?
Yeah, there's two kinds of details that they overlook. They overlook who knows what. There's a lot of people, particularly on the foreign policy side of the government, who are looking constantly at foreign governments, at situations abroad, et cetera, and trying to interpret them. When you go in, as people in the Bush administration did, with a certain mindset and you block out conflicting information, you get in trouble. So the first thing presidents have to do is make sure that they don't block out conflicting information / advice. The second thing they've got to look at is, can the organization that they are giving a new task to, can it do it, right? Does it have enough people? Does it have the right skill sets, et cetera? Sometimes presidents get it right. When George W. Bush expanded Medicare for prescription drug to add prescription drugs, they knew that CMS had to hire lots of pharmacists. They had never had any pharmacists there. So they looked at it, they did the right thing, and that transition went fairly smoothly. But there's a lot of other times when the president simply doesn't take enough time to figure out, does the organization have the ability to do what we're expecting it to do?
What can you tell us about the process by which incoming presidents are, you know, run through orientation in order to take over their jobs? How many things are they given to study? It does seem like a huge challenge, even for the most qualified newly elected president.
You know, the process can best be described as drinking from a fire hose.
Yeah.
Okay. I was privileged to be in the White House in early 1993, and I worked closely with President Clinton and Vice President Gore. And each of them were very experienced in government, and I was a political science PhD, and frankly, everybody was overwhelmed. It is overwhelming even if you have previous government experience, or if you've been studying government all your life, it's still overwhelming. So, you know, part of the trick here is to give the president the time to learn what he or she needs to learn. And that is something that the campaign types never do, because they have come to value what they know how to do, which is communication and messaging. And it happens, they do that at the expense of governing. President in his first year in office really does not have to wander around the country nonstop the way they do during the campaign. They can take a little bit more time to make sure that they get things right, because when they get things wrong, those campaign skills are of no help.
Is there a way that we could change the process of orientation so that maybe it begins, you know, November 15th or something in a really fundamental way? I know there are some things ongoing. There are security briefings. But are, say, you know, incoming presidents learning about what the FDA does or what the EPA does?
You know, there's no systematic way for them to do that. There really isn't for the president himself. Now, there's gargantuan transition teams set up. In fact, they're being set up now. In fact, one of the very positive things that the George W. Bush administration did was that they streamlined the transition process, especially for national security, because they understood how important it was for one administration to have a clean handoff to the next one on all the pressing issues of the day, such as terrorism and other threats. So kudos to the Bush administration for pushing for that legislation. So there is a transition. The problem is that you can't possibly learn that between, you know, Election Day and Inauguration Day. It needs to be something that the president is paying pretty constant attention to, particularly topic by topic. So healthcare is a huge world unto itself. A military acquisition is a huge world unto itself. Public housing is a huge world unto itself. And in each instance, there are pieces of the government that, first of all, know things the president needs to know. And secondly, the president needs to know, are these pieces of the government capable of doing what I'm expecting them to do? And that simply takes time. And there's no replacement for that. You know, there's no quick answer for that.
There's no serious discussion or any discussion at all that I'm aware of about, you know, restructuring the executive branch of the United States government. But I wonder if you think countries that divide out responsibilities between a president and a prime minister fare better in these ways, do not fail in these ways that you've described.
Well, that's an interesting question. Clearly, countries that have a queen and a prime minister or a president and a prime minister take some of the symbolic actions of the chief executive and take them off the backs of the prime minister, who's the person who, in most of these countries, actually governs. So it certainly probably helps. But we never did that in our country, and I can't imagine us doing that in our country. And so we're pretty much stuck with a president who has to be everything, has to be the symbolic leader of the nation as well as the head of the government. And I think that they can do it, but they need to just reorient the time that they spend and the organization of the White House to make sure that they're paying more attention to the government they run.
We have an email here from Henry who writes, anyone who plans to run for president or vice president should be required to attend a government school tailored to those offices. We require our senior military officers to attend the War College before they can be promoted to general. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, it's a good idea. I mean, I can't imagine a president actually doing that. Probably the best way to do that is to urge presidents to build into their White House staff the capacity to look at the federal government and to be constantly reviewing it and reporting to the president on what they're finding. And that is easier to do. If the president was having regular briefings on the capacity, say, of the Medicare program or the organization of the Medicare program or any of the other really big pieces of government that Americans rely on, Social Security Administration, et cetera. If the president was having regular briefings on how are they doing, are there problems there, what are people saying about it, et cetera, you know, I think that we would have a much better functioning presidency and we would probably reduce the probability of failure. It's not just, by the way, the president that's become distant from the federal government. The Congress, which is supposed to have oversight authority, has also become distant. So it used to be that congressional committees would be constantly grilling the executive and looking for problems, et cetera. Congress these days, in the spirit of wanting to just say no to everything, has done a peculiar thing. They have cut their own ability to have oversight of the executive branch by cutting some key agencies like the Congressional Research Service that provide them with information on what's going on in the executive branch. So again, it's this peculiar mindset that because we don't like government and government is bad, we're going to just cut everything and make everything work worse, as opposed to, you know, giving ourselves the capacity to figure out what we might want to get rid of and what we might want to keep.
So, Elaine, what do you recommend to those of us who don't have PhDs in political science, who don't have the time to be more than, you know, relatively well-informed citizens, to ensure that we spend our votes with people that are qualified to do the job? You know, it's hard for anybody, mm-hmm. really, from a distance, from the distance at which we observe our candidates for the presidency, to know whether the things they promise, the ideas they propose, are feasible, and whether they have the stuff to make them happen or the knowledge to understand what they've proposed for us. So how can we look at what they do, look at the things they tell us, and really know who to believe and what qualities they possess?
Well, I think one of the things to do is actually very simple, which is to constantly ask our candidates, not just for president, but all the way down, okay, that sounds good. How are you going to do that? And where are you going to get the money from? You know, just two simple questions. How are you going to do it? Where's the money coming from? And that is something that some candidates can answer. And some candidates will just give you, you know, a bunch of baloney on it, or they'll just obfuscate the answer because they don't really know. Their answers may be incomplete or short, but a candidate has to have an answer to how are you going to do it. Too many candidates these days just say, I'm going to do this, end of sentence. And, you know, there's a lot of good things. I mean, I'd like to be, you know, in the Olympics, Olympic swimmer, okay, but I'm not an Olympic swimmer. And by saying I'd like to be an Olympic swimmer, I'm not going to be one. and so I think that we have to really ask presidents, how do you expect that you're going to do this? And see if we get a reasonable answer. I think the second thing is that we have to look at what their peers think of them. What do other people who do know about government, who are in the business of government, what do they think of the candidate? So what do other governors think of them? What do senators think of these people? You know, because they have usually seen them in action and they have an ability that most of the general public doesn't have to sort of give you a sense of whether or not they think the person running for office is capable.
Would you be in favor of giving presidential candidates, maybe in debate form, some kind of quiz to test their knowledge of the government itself?
Oh, absolutely. And I wouldn't make it a, you know, a gotcha quiz. I
right.
mean, you know, I mean, I think it was a little unfair when they, you know, kept asking George W. Bush, you know, the capitals of obscure African countries, right? I think that was kind of in the gotcha category. Mm-hmm. But to use an example from this campaign, you know, it was pretty clear that Donald Trump didn't know what the nuclear triad is. Now, most average Americans don't need to know what the nuclear triad is, but boy, oh boy, oh boy,
the president
of the United
does.
States needs to know it because it is the foundation of our defense against nuclear war. So that's kind of a big deal. And I think that there are things that the press needs to ask candidates to make sure that the candidates are just ready to do the job we're electing them to do.
Elaine C. Kmark is Senior Fellow in the Governance Studies Program at Brookings and Founding Director of the Center for Effective Public Management. Her new book is called Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again. Elaine, thank you so much for making this time for us today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate being on.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones from Frankie Paris. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.